The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there. And, of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. As you may know and recall, since Putin's second invasion of Ukraine began, the United States and its NATO allies have provided a great deal of aid and weaponry to Ukraine. I'm here now with Ambassador Oksana Markarova from the Ukraine, the Ukrainian ambassador to the United States. Madam Ambassador, welcome. Good morning. Thank you for joining me.
Good morning, Hugh. Thank you for having me.
I want to start with the most important question. What does Ukraine need in terms of weaponry the most from the United States right now?
Well, Hugh, that's a difficult and easy question at the same time, because the right answer would be to say everything. Of course, we are fighting for 768 days an enemy, which is so much bigger than us. So from air defense to artillery to everything that is becoming scarce, as we see, and Russia intensifies the attacks, we need all the support that we can get. And yet, even without additional support for months now, Ukraine is not only holding a very long line, but also continues to destroy the Russian Black Sea fleet and continues to attack Russia's oil refineries and other directly war-related objects with our own capabilities. But of course, in order to win faster, in order to liberate people who suffer on the territories which Russia still control, we need additional support, and there is a range of capabilities that we lack.
When you say everything, I know that that is the correct answer, but let's drill down a bit and start specifically. I know you're trying to get Patriots from Raytheon. Does that look like it's going to happen?
Well, you know, with air defense, it's essential part of being able to continue the effort, because not only Russia fights on the front line, we know that on a daily basis they do these attacks with Iranian-built Shahid drones, with North Korean-built missiles and Russian missiles everywhere in Ukraine. Odessa is under constant pressure. Kyiv is being hit by missiles. Kharkiv, Dnipro, so many hospitals, residential areas are pounded on a daily basis. So air defense is key. And, of course, Patriots have shown unbelievable results with Ukrainian defenders using them in the very effective way. Not only they are taking down everything that we thought they could, but including the Russia's so-called supersonic missile. So yes, you know, more interceptors and more Patriot and Patriot type capabilities. We're also receiving some from European colleagues, you know, IRIS-Ts and others. Nothing, of course, can compare to Patriots. But yes, we need them as many as our partners can provide.
Now, is the holdup there Congress, or is the holdup there Raytheon? Because I can't believe any member of Congress would be opposed to selling you more Patriots, because seeing the pictures of the apartment buildings and the civilian casualties, everybody knows Russia is waging a war crime-driven war. And that's not in doubt. And Patriots stop war crimes from happening. So is the bottleneck Raytheon, or is it Congress?
Well, Hugh, there is a number of challenges we have to resolve in order to be able to get more. Of course, we all pray and hope Congress will support additional appropriations. This is needed in order for Pentagon to be able to continue providing it. But even when we had this generously provided by Congress for supplementary funds in the past, it's not the only thing that we need in order to get it. You're absolutely right. The production in all the countries, all the peaceful countries, where we were not preparing for war, is not where we needed to be in order to be able to counter an enemy like Russia. That's why we're not only asking American companies to help or the Congress to help, but we're working really hard on co-production. and working with a number of American companies to start production, at least some components, if not the whole capabilities in Ukraine, so that we can defend us, but also defend other friends and allies. So it's there is a lot of challenges which we have to overcome, but we have to do it in order to win.
How much time of your day, Madam Ambassador, do you spend talking to legislators, and how much time of your day do you spend talking to executive branch and then to contractors? There are three buckets: Congress people, executive branch people, DOD in the White House, and then defense contractors. How does your day divide up? And then there are knuckleheads like me who are on media.
Hugh, it feels like I'm talking 24/7 to all three of them. And it's sometimes it's more in some areas and sometimes in others. But I'm so happy to be doing what I'm doing with you now, talking to American people, because we were able to be where we are and to win because American people support us. And it's so important for American people to understand why it is important for all of us to win, why we have to stay the course now when Russia is uniting forces with North Korea, Iran, Hamas. We have to show that we are stronger.
Two of my closest friends, for the benefit of the audience, Dan Poneman, who I've known for 50 years, and Dan Rundy, who I've known since I got to D.C., they're both on the Democrat and the Republican side. They said, they got to talk to this ambassador. I got to talk to you because you make the case. So tell me, are you an optimist? You've been in D.C. since 2021. You've been doing the diplomatic effort for many years. You're also a Hoosier. You're an honorary Hoosier. You're an IU grad. So are you an optimist as well? Yeah, they're not making it to the Final Four this year, Madam Ambassador. Sorry about that. But are you an optimist about the war?
You really have to do that and say that about the final. You know, I am devoted Hoosier. So, look, I have to be an optimist, as all Ukrainians, from President Zelensky to people on the front line to people everywhere in Kyiv, Bucha, or Kharkiv, or Odessa. You know, it's existential for us to defend ourselves. We're defending our homes, our loved ones, but we're also defending the freedom and democracy, something on which this country is built on. And, you know, let's look back, you know, during these 2 years, very difficult 2 years, we suffered a lot, we lost a lot. But what we were able to do together with the support of our friends is nothing short of a miracle, you know. Not only Russia did not take us in 3 days or 3 weeks, not only we liberated 50% of the territories and, frankly, destroyed or damaged more than a third now of Russian Black Sea Fleet, not only we are holding a very long 800 miles line of front, being so much smaller in size and defense capabilities, but we are also sending resounding message to all the autocrats that it's not okay in the 21st century to redraw the borders by brutal force or to conduct genocides against a peaceful neighbor. And, you know, you said I'm a Hoosier. I felt myself at home in Indiana because partially probably because my mom comes from a farmer's community. Ah. And, you know, when you live on the when you live and you're part of the farmer's community, when something happens to another farmer, you go and help. And it doesn't matter whether it's a farmer who's your neighbor right next to you or someone who you never met in other village, you know. And this is what it is about. We are so much like Americans. We believe in the same values. We want to live peacefully, just raise our kids, you know, raise food, grow food. And we were never a threat to Russia or to anyone.
Now, 25 years ago, Madam Ambassador, 25 years ago, my daughter went on 2 mission trips to Kyiv after the fall of the Soviet Union, after Ukraine. And it was getting up on its feet. It was beginning to stand up. There was organized crime. There were problems. When you were before the first invasion and certainly before the second invasion, what did you foresee as the future of Ukraine? Because she saw a pretty remarkable country 25 years ago. I haven't been there. So tell me, was it on a trajectory that you thought would bring it into the top 20 economies in the world?
Absolutely, Hugh. You know, in 2013, when Russia attacked us, we got to peaceful accords. We started reforming our country. That's when I joined the government. And, you know, we started building Ukraine, which is modern, innovative, European, free of corruption, future member of European Union and NATO. Everything that we believed in, we were firmly on the path of becoming one of the fastest growing economies in Eastern Europe. That's why Putin attacked us. because he didn't want a democratic, peaceful, prosperous example for his own people right next to him. That's the only reason we were never a threat. And I am positive that after we win, and we have to win together, we will come back on this path, and the reconstruction of Ukraine will allow us to leapfrog into this Ukraine 2.0, which is not only going to be good for Ukrainians, but it's going to be a solution in energy, agriculture, food security, digital, and everything else, part of the solution to global challenges and a reliable partner to the United States.
Before the war, Ukraine, we're going to take a break in 2 minutes, Madam Ambassador, then we'll come back. Before the war, Ukraine was feeding the world. It was the world's breadbasket. It has always been the world's breadbasket. If anyone knows anything about wheat and other grains, they come from Ukraine in a large percentage. Has that gotten back to pre-war capacity yet, or is it still limited?
Well, right after, with our own capabilities, we restored the grain corridor, and not only grain corridor, we again are feeding the world. But yes, Russia tried to block it by blocking the Black Sea, and there was a big problem during the first 2 years of war. Now, thanks to our brave defenders, we're back, and we're sending. Of course, it's not where it used to be. Ukraine used to be in top five of all major products, including sunflower oil, we were number one, and grain, different types of grain. But we are on the trajectory to do that. Now, we need a little bit more air defense and other capabilities in order to be able to have that in a sustainable manner.
Yeah, we have 1 minute left to the break, and then we'll come back, Madam. You mentioned air defense again. To me, that's the number one thing, and that's why I brought up Patriots so early. If you can't defend your people, it's very hard to run anything. How many Patriot batteries or other air defense batteries are there now deployed around the country in rough terms?
Well, that's something I cannot tell you as the number, but I can tell you not enough. You know, we need more air defense to protect everywhere in Ukraine, and especially not only residential areas, but also those areas which are very important for export production, food security, and everything else.
All right, we'll be right back with Ambassador Makarova when we come back after this break. Don't go anywhere, America. I want to find out, what does she expect in the year ahead? What does she think of the critics both on the right and on the left of aid to Ukraine? What does she think of Speaker Johnson's new plan, which I think is going to pass? Finally, I think we're going to get hardware over there, Senator Cotton. I just think serious Republicans everywhere have got to come around and rally to the idea that the United States would never, ever not aid someone attacked in an unprovoked fashion this way by a Russian thug dictator who has himself bent on not just Ukraine, but the Baltic states and Poland. You got to understand the whole game, and Russia, Iran, and China are the whole game, and they're coming after everyone who's in their way. Don't go anywhere. I'll be back with Ambassador Makarova right after this. You're listening to the Tuesday edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, inside the Beltway, talking with Ambassador Makarova. She is Ukraine's ambassador to the United States. Madam Ambassador, our friend Dan Rundy has told me that in Russia-occupied Ukraine, there are a number of religious minorities, Baptists, Adventists, Roman Catholics like me, who are being brutalized by the Russians. Is that true? And if so, how do we help those people?
I wouldn't even call them minorities. You know, Ukraine has a great diversity among Christians, and we pretty much have a number of evangelical and Protestant Baptist churches, in addition to Orthodox Catholics, Greek Catholics that we have in Ukraine. And it all flourishes, and we all live peacefully and pray together. Whereas Russia prohibits specifically, sometimes it's for all Christians, sometimes they criminalize some particular churches, but the horrifying stories that we hear from Ukrainian Baptists, from Ukrainian Catholics, from Ukrainian Orthodox on the territories where Russia still illegally occupies them is horrifying. They specifically target priests. They prohibit people to gather in churches. They destroy churches. We now have already a big map of the religious places destroyed by the Russians, and it's not a collateral damage. They have been targeted specifically. So there is big threat to religious freedom, not only on the controlled by Russia territories, but in general in Russia. We know how many Christian churches are prohibited in Russia. We have seen it during 10 years in Crimea. So it's a pattern that we see over and over again.
So, Madam Ambassador, I also, among the many war crimes that Putin has committed against Ukraine, they've kidnapped thousands of Ukrainian children. Do you know where they are? Do they try and communicate some way? What has happened to these children?
You know, the prosecutor general already registered more than 128,000 individual war crime cases, which they're investigating and prosecuting. Wow. You're absolutely right. The most horrific of them is the kidnapping of Ukrainian children. We have at least 20,000 cases registered that we know of kids that have been abducted by Russians. Russians themselves brag about 700,000. The problem is because they do not share any information with us, because we do not know what happened to so many children from Mariupol and other places, which Russia still occupies. It's a crime where I think we don't see the magnitude even yet. But as you know, one child abducted is one too many. And they are taking them and putting them for speedy adoptions into Russian families. They are putting teenagers through this re-educational camps, which is horrible. It's a torture camps for Ukrainian youth where they are forced to not only speak Russian, but deny that they're Ukrainians. They've been brutally physically and emotionally abused. Why do we know all of that? Because we have freed already more than 300 of them. Yes, not enough, but we have had their accounts. They're testifying in Ukraine. They testified in Congress in front of the Helsinki Commission. So it's a horrible crime for which Putin personally is indicted by the ICC, International Criminal Court. And there is a global arrest warrant for him personally and for his so-called children's ombudsman, Lvova Belova, who abducted a child herself. This is something that has to be punished. Everyone has to be held under account. And look, Putin is a war criminal on so many accounts. But as the mother, I think this is the one which will land him on the bench in The Hague and in prison.
A last question, Madam Ambassador. I keep urging my Republican friends to support weapons for Ukraine if they can't bring themselves for the full aid package. I'd like all the aid package, but I'll take the weapons. What's the best thing the audience can do to help persuade American legislators left, right and center that Ukraine needs to get this aid now?
Well, first of all, I think right now we just need everyone who support us to make it public, you know, write to your congressmen or senators, call them, tell them that you support us. When Americans put our flags outside of your houses, and I know how important and valuable and precious flags, American flags for Americans are, this is a direct message to anyone who sees it, that American people are with us and that they support this fight. And they understand that this fight is not just a fight for Ukraine. It's a fight for all of us. It's a fight for democracy and freedom. It's a fight for values in which we believe, and it's important. It's a fight for what President Reagan called, you know, a fight for the Americans, and that America will never, break face with those who fight for the same values, regardless of where it is.
Well, you know how to get to me. I'm old enough to have worked for the man, so you're right, Ambassador. It is nice to meet you virtually. I look forward to meeting you in person. Thank you for spending time with me. Got you up early this morning, but Ambassador Marco Rubio, thank you so much. We will continue to ask Speaker Johnson to move this package quickly and get it back to the White House for President Biden's signature so we can continue to stand with Ukraine, which is really the only right, justifiable, moral American thing to do, and we got to keep doing it. Thank you, Ambassador Makarova. I'll be right back, America, tomorrow. I want to thank Harley and Adam. If you missed that, and I'm going to put it onto the podcast today. It will leave the podcast today, along with everything else. Thank you so much for watching the Hugh Hewitt Show today. I'll be back tomorrow on the next Hugh Hewitt Show. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt, live inside the Beltway on this Tuesday morning. Hope it's a good one for you. It was not a good one for the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps yesterday. At least three senior commanders, four officers, in addition to those senior commanders, overseeing Iran's covert operations in the Middle East were killed yesterday. I'm reading from news items from John Ellis. When Israel warplanes struck a building in Damascus that is part of the Iranian embassy complex, according to Iranian and Syrian officials, the strike in Damascus, the Syrian capital, appeared to be among the deadliest attacks in a year-long shadow war between Israel and Iran that included the assassinations of Iranian military leaders and nuclear scientists, that covert war has moved into the open. Of course it has. Iran is arming Hezbollah and Hamas. Iran is at war with Israel. Of course it was. From the Times of Israel comes word that Iran and Hezbollah vow, quote, punishment and revenge for strike that killed the IRGC generals. I'm not sure what more they can do other than what they have been doing, which is killing Israeli citizens and soldiers in the north and aiding Hamas in the south. Seven aid workers were killed, probably by the Israeli Defense Forces. They have expressed great remorse, but they're investigating. We will keep you posted on that. They are with World Central Kitchen. I don't know what World Central Kitchen is, but they are innocent Good Samaritans who are dead in Gaza because Hamas will not surrender. And don't expect Israel to stop the war. They will be very sorry for the loss of humanitarian aid workers who are operating in a war zone, but they're not going to stop. The only way to stop is for Hamas to surrender or be defeated. The U.S. also said that Israel has agreed to take their concerns over the Rafah operation into account, which means basically Rafah is going to happen after Ramadan, and then they're going to occupy the strip for as long as it takes to blow up all the tunnels, and then they're going to leave, and then the world can rebuild it. Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, has outlined a plan for Ukraine aid. I will be talking with Ukraine's ambassador to the United States, Ambassador Makarova, later in the program today. Don't miss that. Part of the aid package will include the ability to export liquefied natural gas, which is crucial, not just to Louisiana, where the facility is located, but to all of Europe. And for inexplicable reasons, Joe Biden vetoed that. A car bomb killed a pro-Russian official in occupied Ukraine. The resistance is never going to end. Former President Trump posted a $175 million bond in New York yesterday. He will eventually get that back because the Judge Engoron was such a crash test dummy judge, and Letitia James brought such a obviously corrupt civil suit against Donald Trump. He's going to win that. The deal wards off the $454 million judgment for now, according to the New York Times. It's never going to get paid because it was a, I almost said a bad word, case. And it's just going to be that way. Now, Trump will be convicted in Manhattan next month in April. The trial starts in April, but it will probably take at least 3 or 4 weeks. So I think he'll be convicted in May. He won't go to jail. That's another blank case. And everybody knows it. Everybody knows it, that Alvin Bragg has absolutely stretched the law to its breaking point. It just needs to get to an appeals court. But it ain't going to get there until he's convicted. So all the folks at MSNBC and NBC can say all day long he's a convicted felon. He's not going to be a convicted felon for long. It will be turned over on appeal. And maybe they'll get lucky and find one honest man or woman on the jury who says this is nuts. Because basically everyone knows it's nuts. And they're just going to have to do, if you've never seen 12 Angry Men, Lee J. Cobb, and it's old, it's black and white, and it's back in the day when only men were on juries, and one guy wants to go to a baseball game. That's all I remember. He's waiting to go to a baseball game. I think that may be Lee J. Cobb. And they're sweating. There's one fan. It's really a remarkable case about an individual who will not give in because he is unclear about the burden of proof being met, and it won't be met in Trump's case. It's a nonsense case. But I expect Manhattan, you know, they're just going to convict him. Florida court has allowed the 6-week Florida abortion ban to stand and also allowed an initiative on abortion to be on the ballot in November. And that's good. That's the people's will. And the people have a right of initiative in Florida, so they will take that. Caitlin Clark beat LSU. I should say Iowa beat LSU to go to the women's Final Four last night. First time I'm mentioning this, the avian bird flu, H5N1, is back. The second known human case of H5N1 occurred in Texas. Nothing to get excited about. It's just I like to let you know when we have a pandemic about to begin. As I did with COVID, always keep my eye on the unusual viruses out there. Guess what? Oregon, according to the New York Times, is recriminalizing drug use. What a surprise. Portland figured out that decriminalizing all drug use would lead to a lot of drug use and a lot of associated terrible toll on people's lives, on the city, on property values, on business. It's a hellhole in Portland. Nobody wants to live there. Nobody wants to go there. And so they're recriminalizing drug use. What? Boy, that was not hard to predict. Poor nations are writing a new handbook for getting rich, according to Patricia Cohen. What I love about this is the assumption that the New York Times can tell you what's going on in poor nations on the basis of Patricia Cohen reporting from London. Ever think about that? Headline, poor nations are writing a new handbook for getting rich. You know, there are hundreds of nations. They're all different. They all want to get rich and traditionally have gone from farming to manufacturing to service industry. And she's pointing out that robots are there. Now, I'm summarizing the argument. Now, robots do a lot of the work that the workers did when they left the farm. So now they're going to have to go into the service industry. And boy, look right here at this big call center in India. That's the whole story. They must be running out of things to write. If you're watching The Three Body Problem, I'm listening to it first. I'm almost done with book two of the three books. It's wild. And then I'm going to watch the first hour of the Netflix show because I knew it wouldn't spoil the rest of it. And that was great. And John Podhoretz on the commentary pod, which is part of the subject of my new Fox News column today, which I will get to. If you don't know anything about the Israel war or you rely on mainstream media, you need to dive into the world of podcasts. And I give you the big four in this column. If you want to be smart, one of them is commentary. Two are from the Times of Israel. One is Dan Senor. And I explain it, and I posted the link to the Fox column over at HughHewitt.com. My Morning Glory column comes out on Tuesdays and Thursdays on FoxNews.com. But the bizarre Chinese murder plot behind Netflix Three-Body Problem, that's a bad headline because the murder of the guy who funded it, Lin Kui, who was a billionaire with a dream. He wanted to see the Three-Body Problem made into a good Netflix series, so he funded it. And it's drawn millions of viewers, doing quite well. It's very good. But he's dead. He was poisoned by a fellow employee. I'm not interested in that story. Lots of people get poisoned in the United States. I do like the show. I told you Mike Johnson has outlined the plan for Ukraine aid. The House could act on it within weeks. And now we can go to some audio tape of this is one of those audio tapes, which I should add yesterday, but Dwayne wouldn't give it to me. Fed Chairman Jerome Powell talking at the Monterey Policy Institute with Kai Ryssdal. Cut number one.
So this is one of the things, you know, we've had our policy rate at 5.3%, which is the highest rate in more than two decades for some time. And all through the course of 2023, we saw very strong growth. Yep. So it's and that's partly because this has happened in a context of supply side healing, which makes its own growth, you know, when potential output goes up. So we don't really know where rates are going to go back to when this whole thing is over. For many years, if you go back to before the global financial crisis, it wasn't unusual to see the longer-term rates in the fours. And so are we going to go back to, whereas in the sort of time between the global financial crisis and the pandemic, rates went lower and lower and lower, and it wasn't unusual to see in other countries long-term rates below zero, even mm-hmm. in Europe. They never went that low in the United States, but they went very low. So are they going to go back up to those higher levels of the pre-global financial crisis? We really don't know. We think that the factors that led rates that really came down over a 40-year period mostly related to big, slow-moving things like demographics, aging population, which saves more, and productivity, low productivity, and things like that. Those things don't jump around. They're sort of slow-moving objects. But the truth is we don't know. My own expectation is I don't think rates will go back down to the very, very low levels they were at before.
That's the home run. You're not going to have a choice. You're going to have to buy a house at 5 to 6%. That's the reality, and that's the way it is. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Don't go anywhere. I'll be right back on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Good morning, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. David Drucker joins me. He of the Dispatch. Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm great, Hugh. Good morning.
David, we were talking about polls before you came on. And yesterday, Michael Steele asked David Plouffe, how do we get the young people back? And he said, basically, they're not coming back. Maybe you'll pick up some Republicans. My question to you is, why are we running anything other than the five-way race now? I see that people like Morning Consult and Rasmussen, they run both Trump, Biden head-to-head, and then they run one with Kennedy, Stein, and Cornel West. It's very clear to me that Kennedy, Stein, and Cornel West are going to be on a lot of ballots. So why don't we just go with the five-way race for our polling?
Well, I mean, as somebody who's covering this pretty closely, I don't think we know if they're going to be on a lot of ballots or not. And I don't think we know what a lot means. So I'm not disagreeing with you per se. What I'm saying is I'm waiting to see how many ballots they get on and on which ballots are they. And then once we know that, I think it'll make it a lot easier for the polling.
The Shanahan pick by Kennedy was a money play to get the money to get on the ballot, right?
I can't think of any other reason why he picked her, because to me, it's not a serious pick. He's not really positioning himself to pick up a third of the country in theory that you would need, let's say a third of the support in enough states to win electoral votes. I mean, you know, I don't have to tell you, Ross Perot won, you know, 19% of the vote, won zero electoral votes, and everything Kennedy is doing right now is something that a niche candidate does that's not making a broader play to win. Maybe in his mind he is, but he's just not.
What did you make of Shanahan?
I just don't make anything of her. I mean, she doesn't. Look, what you try to do with a vice president is, one, number one, do no harm. Number two, give people this idea that you're going to surround yourself with competent people for the job at hand. And number three, if something happens to the president, that this person could step in. And this is not a Mike Pence pick. It's not a Dick Cheney pick. It's not a Joe Biden 2008 pick. It's not an Al Gore pick. It's not that pick. I mean, look, even Kamala Harris, who has turned out to not be a very inspiring vice president, you know, was a United States senator and a former state attorney general at the time. And you know, even though Kennedy looks like a healthy guy, he's in his 70s, you know, you want to, the age is good. But other than that, I just don't see anything that screams vice president there.
And now my short list, which I've said over and over again, is Tom Cotton, Joni Ernst, and Mike Pompeo, because they are all serious people. They're all veterans. I know J.D. Vance is out there, but he hasn't been in D.C. long enough. I think Trump wins in a walk if he put Cotton or Pompeo on there. I think probably Joni Ernst as well. What do you think?
I mean, in theory, you know, what you want to do, what Trump might want to do with the vice president, with the pick of the vice president, is to do what he did with Mike Pence, which is to try and show that the traditional faction, the faction of traditional Republicans, of Reagan Republicans, that that I know who you are and I want your support and you are a part of my coalition. You know, Tom Cotton could fit that. Mike Pompeo can definitely fit that. I think Mike Pompeo in particular, just because he's more known and has been, you know, more vocal. Joni Ernst would be an interesting pick. I don't think it's a matter of pick this person and you win, because it's always about the top of the ticket. But I think what we don't know is, does Trump believe that he needs to send a signal to the Reagan faction of the coalition, or does he believe that he's moved beyond that and no longer needs to do that and just is going to pick somebody who fits,
you know,
with
David,
him?
I just want to get your reaction to this. I never believed that vice presidents mattered even a little until this year, but they are both older men. Joe Biden's really old, and Kamala Harris scares people. She really does scare people, and therefore, the contrast with the vice president will matter a lot. So don't put in someone from.
I do agree with that, but we're trying to get inside Trump's head, and it's a matter of how Trump looks at this. You know, if you're Trump and you're looking at the polling right now, you probably feel pretty invincible, especially after, you know, all of the reasons why you shouldn't be in this position, beginning with, you know, the day that he refused to concede to Biden and claim the election was stolen, and then January 6th and all the different things he says that people say should make him unelectable, but he's not unelectable. So it's about what Trump thinks. So I totally agree it matters, Hugh. I'm just trying to game out what's in Trump's head, and it's really hard to do.
Well, I know what's in his head is he wants someone who will go out there every day and say he's getting screwed by the courts. And that means someone who can campaign.
Right, but he could do that with J.D. Vance. He could do that with a lot of people that that don't necessarily fit, you know, the category that, you know, you think he should pick or I think he should pick or whatever. And that's what I'm getting at.
My only caution about JD, he's been through one campaign and it has, he has not had the screws put to him the way that Pompeo, Cotton, and Ernst have been, because they went through many, many campaigns. But we shall see.
Totally.
David M. Drucker on X. What's that, David?
You want somebody seasoned.
Yeah, seasoned. Seasoned. Not cooling to room temperature, but seasoned. David M. Drucker on X. Thank you. Senior writer at the Dispatch. I'll be right back. Byron York is next. America, stay tuned. Joined by Byron York of the Washington Examiner, where he's the chief political correspondent, Fox News contributor. Good morning, Byron. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. Doing well. Thank you.
Let me begin by asking you, I've been studying the aftermath of the NBC News meltdown when they hired and then did something with Ronna McDaniel. I don't think they fired her from what I'm reading.
Yeah.
I think they're paying her. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, obviously, they're going to have a legal problem with Ronna McDaniel, and she has hired, I believe, a lawyer who, among other things, represented Megyn Kelly in her dispute, I think, with NBC, not with Fox, but with NBC. And obviously, she was not fired for cause, if she was indeed fired. And so for however long the contract is, it seems like she would be entitled to that amount of money. And she's probably going to add on top of that some sort of appeal for damages, for example, having been exposed to a hostile work environment. And I got to say, if you watched MSNBC for a couple of days, that was a pretty darn hostile environment as far as Ronna McDaniel was concerned.
Well, it started with Kristen and Chuck on Sunday, and then they got the ball rolling, and she got dragged. She got dragged for absolutely 48 hours. I don't know that they're talking about her now. I think they probably gotten a memo, shut up, you're costing us money. But it was a hostile workplace. It was, I think, defamatory in a couple of instances. So when do you think we hear something about this, Byron? And by the way, do you think there's any downside for Comcast and NBC News with this?
Well, Mike, I think the downside has already happened for them. There was certainly a downside. It was terribly embarrassing. And you know, Reince Priebus was on one of the Sunday shows the other day and offered a very simple comment, which is, you know, why didn't they try her out first? Have her on the air a few times before signing her as a contributor and see if she did well, see if she kind of fit in, et cetera, et cetera. And see how that worked. And the staff would have known, you know, something was up. And then maybe this whole thing wouldn't have happened the way it did. But, I mean, there's clearly been a downside for NBC because it's just an absolutely embarrassing moment for them. And also,
I have a theory on who got hurt the worst by this.
Yes.
And it is Kristen Welker, because she's taking off on Meet the Press. Chuck doesn't succeed. They remove Chuck. And I like Chuck. Chuck's smart. But it didn't work because he's too far to the left. So they bring in Kristen, who doesn't have a reputation for being a lefty or a righty or much of anything. And all of a sudden, she's branded as the person who blew up Ronna McDaniel. I just think it ruined her launch. What do you think?
Also, this has given birth to a classic new phrase about NBC News and perhaps about liberal media in general, which is cohesive and aligned.
Yes. And that, boy, are they ever cohesive and aligned.
Aligned. Man, we are really, really aligned here. That was when Cesar Conde, the head of NBC News, announced that Ronna McDaniel would be leaving, and how the management had learned a lot from the reaction of the employees. And the newsroom had to be two things. It was super important that the newsroom be both cohesive and aligned. And everybody thought, well, cohesive, you know, you want everybody to work as a team, and aligned, meaning, you know, we all have to sort of agree to the same thing.
Well, that is actually the word that was used repeatedly when the Browns, the awful Cleveland Browns, awful since 1999, hired Andrew Berry and Kevin Stefanski 4 years ago, and they're about to get extended. They kept saying, we need an aligned general manager, head of strategy, and head football coach. They have to believe the same thing. And that's true. Or you can't put a football team on the but this isn't a football team. It's the news. Yeah, it's not going to be aligned. And I don't want an aligned show. I've got the ambassador from Ukraine, the United States, on next hour. I'm not aligned with her, but I want to hear what she has to say. Let me go, Byron, to the question I asked David Drucker in the last hour. Do you think it's still useful to do head-to-head polling when we know that Jill Stein, Cornel West, and Robert Kennedy are going to be on many, if not all, ballots?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, because, as you know, most of the polls come out and they've got a head-to-head Biden-Trump number, and then they've got a five-way number with those three additional candidates. And the thing is, it's a little more complicated than that, because, you know, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is on one ballot, so
Utah,
on one ballot in Utah. Now, he said, I think he said on CNN last night or a couple of nights ago that that he's going to be on 100% of the ballots. It's absolutely guaranteed. Well, it's not guaranteed at all. And there'll be some states in which he is and some states in which he isn't. So how do you poll all that? It's a really complex situation. But I guess all you can say is it's going to be more than just a one-on-one head-to-head battle, but it's going to be less than a five-way battle in every state.
Well, what I would like to see is the status of the eight battleground states and ballot access there. And I haven't seen a story on that. Do you know if either of them, Cornel West, I think Jill Stein's on everywhere, because I think the Green Party is on as a matter of course. And I think the Libertarian Party is on as a matter of course. But do we know if Cornel West has made ground, say, in Wisconsin and in Arizona, Nevada, you know, our traditional battlegrounds?
I have to say, I do not know about that.
Right. Last question. MSNBC's Michael Steele, one of the approved Republicans, because he's not a Republican anymore, asked David Plouffe yesterday, what do we do about these young voters who have left? Listen to this answer, cut number 13.
This can seem very nerdy and boring, but politics is about candidates and message and timing. But as you know, it's about math. And a good campaign knows exactly how many votes they need to win a state, and they know where those are going to come from. So if the Biden campaign were to overestimate the number of Republicans they can get, that would be a problem. I don't think they will. And yes, almost all Republicans who didn't vote in the primaries, let's say, are going to come home to Trump. Most of the Haley voters will come home to Trump. Mm-hmm. But you've got a pool of voters out there, very sophisticated data and modeling and research. You can understand who's coming home, no matter how they voted in the primary, and who's actually open either to not voting, as Esper kind of fumbled around about, but ultimately voting for Biden. And so I think you just have to look at it as, how do you get to a win number in these battleground states? And I think that it's a small piece of the pie, but it's an important piece of the pie, particularly when I think Biden is going to have all the challenges in the world of maximizing his both vote share and turnout amongst young people. So in a way, if he can do slightly better with Republicans than he did in 20.
That's good enough. I'm going to have all the problems in the world. Byron York. How does that translate?
I think that was the answer to the question.
Yeah.
You know, that was a very interesting answer in which he was basically talking to some degree about, you know, on the left, you'll see a lot of attention to the number of people in the Republican primaries, the most recent ones, and it's another primary day today, who voted for Nikki Haley, you know, weeks after she pulled out of the race. And they think, aha, those are going to be Biden voters. They will vote for under no circumstances will they vote for Trump. And actually, I think you heard Plouffe say something that's, I think, a very realistic view here, which is that most of them are going to end up voting for Trump, and which doesn't provide the boost to Biden that certainly Biden was hoping for. And then Plouffe delivered further bad news on young voters because his answer was, Biden's going to have a big, hard time with that.
And that's because I think in everything, generally, 18-year-olds do not care what 81-year-olds think, much less are they going to let them decide for them what to do. Byron, last question. I devoted most of yesterday's show to the proposition that there aren't any undecided voters, no statistically significant number of them. And that means that they're either anti-Biden or they're anti-Trump or they're anti-both of them. They're going to vote third party. But there's not a lot of fluidity in this race. What do you think of that?
I agree with that. I think there are a lot of people who essentially tell themselves they're undecided right now, or they tell pollsters that, because, you know, they don't have to decide yet. We're months away from actually casting a ballot. So I think that there are voters who really know where they're going to end up. but they can say they're undecided now because they don't have to decide.
And my point was, the money doesn't really matter. They'll both have a lot of money. Democrats might have twice as much money. But when you're dealing with a rock and a hard place, you really can't move the rock or the hard place, can you?
No, I think the whole one of the trends in politics for a while has been that the number of truly undecided voters and truly independent voters has gotten smaller and smaller. And I think you're right there that there's just not that much play, which means the old cliche about turnout is actually truer. So you got to get more of your team to turn out than the other guy.
If you're not spending your money on people who are actually going to be walking, talking, and driving voters, I'm not sure you're doing a good job. Byron York, thank you, my friend. Beyond the sea. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined by Admiral James Stavridis, retired from the United States Navy, former Allied Supreme Commander, former head of Southern Command, now chair of the Rockefeller Foundation. Morning, Admiral. How are you?
Doing great, Hugh. I'm in Atlanta today to do a couple of book events for 2054.
Excellent. How is 2054 doing?
It's doing great. We're kind of floating around top 50 on the combined Amazon fiction, nonfiction list. And I think we've moved close to 20,000 copies in about 2.5 weeks. So
I think what's going to happen,
but it's pretty good.
Yeah, I think what's going to happen is as we go into the summer reading season, which gets started about Memorial Day, people are going to reach for that. But we will come back to that then. Admiral, what years were you the Supreme Allied Commander?
2009 to 2013, Hugh.
Okay, so it's 10 years after our errant bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade. And a decade later, was that still an issue with which you were aware and had to deal with the after effects of?
Yes. In fact, when I went to Belgrade, Serbians would literally drive me past the buildings that had been struck. They kept them as a kind of like memorial to the event, and it remains high in the consciousness, certainly of the people on the ground in Serbia.
Because we've had two big strikes. Israel struck the Iranian embassy in Syria, killing at least two IRGC generals and five other senior staffers who had been plotting with Hezbollah and maybe Hamas. And then seven aid workers were killed in what is probably an IDF errant strike last night. Can you explain to us how such strikes can happen both intentionally with such precision and unintentionally with such damage to Israel's reputation, though it's a war and everyone understands that?
Yeah, this is the two faces of war. You think of the Roman god Janus, whose two faces, peace and war. Here you have an entirely evil and malevolent gathering of high-level terrorists, and I would include the Iranians, Hamas, Hezbollah, all floating around that embassy in Damascus, which has become kind of the planning central for Hezbollah, Hamas. I'm sure they discussed the Houthi attacks in the Red Sea. So malevolent, evil, and clearly directed strike that took out a very high-level IRGC, someone who had every intention of furthering the terror attacks against the state of Israel. My view, a legitimate strike. On the other hand, here you have food aid workers from World Central Kitchen, directed by Jose Andres, one of the true great humanitarians of our time. This is an organization that is trying its best to get food into Gaza. I'm certain what happened is that tiny convoy, I think it was only two vehicles, probably mistakenly identified as a movement of a high-level Hamas. Probably based on intercepts, cell phones, the targeteers did everything they could, I'm sure, to avoid collateral damage. But at the end of the day, the strike occurred, I'm sure, because Israel believed that there was yet another malevolent actor. But it's a moment of classic irony on the battlefield. The bad guys take a shot and the good guys, in this case, the aid workers, get shot. tragic
I'll come back to the bad
game.
Guys in a second. You just used a term of art, targeteer. Who are they? Who are the targeteers?
Yeah, these are, sure, these are very high level, typically Navy captains or Air Force colonels who are themselves aviators, who have typically conducted many of these missions themselves. They get pulled up to higher headquarters to analyze every single target release. And the campaign in my mind here is one that I directed, the campaign in Libya, 2011, which was directed at, by the United Nations to go after the forces of Muammar Gaddafi. The targeteers are small group operators. They are aided by typically a judge advocate general who examines all this. Often you have individuals who have experience on the ground, shall we say, intelligence operatives. I'll leave it at that. And they look at each strike in excruciating detail. This is not World War II bombing campaigns where thousands of bombs are being dropped in a single day. This is looking at the precision-guided strikes. The targeteers are the ones who make the recommendation to the commander whether to take a shot or not.
That reminds me, have you seen the Masters of the Air yet, Admiral? That's what my uncle did for 29 missions, not as a captain, he's a gunner, but I'm just curious if you've seen it yet.
Oh, of course. And, you know, as a Navy guy, I'm required to say it's almost as good as Greyhounds, which is the destroyer at sea version, Tom Hanks doing the convoys. Listen, both of those groups of people were extraordinary heroes. Masters of the Air is absolutely brilliant.
All right. So now we're talking about targeteers, and we're talking about the ones who decided we're going to hit the Iranian embassy. And that's a big step, Admiral. Can you unpack the significance of that for us? Because embassies are sovereign territory. That means Israel struck Iran yesterday.
Absolutely. And I think that that was a strike that undoubtedly had to be approved by the prime minister, certainly by the minister of defense, probably by the entire war cabinet. It is absolutely an act of war. The reason the Israelis would get to that moment and decide to take that strike is pretty obvious, and that's that they're already de facto in a war with Iran, which has again and again and again stated that their primal desire is to destroy the state of Israel and kill every Jew in the world. So if you're on the receiving end of that kind of war mentality, I think it is not a hard step to get to the point of taking out a very high-level leader. Final thought, this was not like striking the Chinese embassy. You gave that example a moment ago, which was a mistake by the United States. We didn't intend to do that. This was, by all accounts, a deliberate strike, and I think it stands and is legitimate under the laws of war.
When you were running the Libya campaign, did you have any errant strikes?
We did not have anything that approaches the level of what tragically occurred yesterday with the aid workers being killed, or frankly, the United States. You may remember, Hugh, during the debacle of a withdrawal from Afghanistan.
Oh, yes.
We took out a father and his family. He was merely trying to get some water to his family. We thought it was a bomb maker. United States took that shot. These tragedies happen. During the campaign in Libya, I can't recall one, but we dropped probably 25,000 precision-guided strikes. I'm sure they weren't perfect, but I can assure you of this. Every single strike that we made was vetted, approved at least a three-star level by the Joint Task Force commander, a Canadian lieutenant general, don't forget, NATO operation, and was backed up by American targeteers, the best in the world.
All right, now let me turn to what this means going forward. Iran is functionally at war with Israel because they are, Hezbollah is Iran, Iran is Hezbollah. The same is not true about Hamas, so it's almost true. But Hezbollah is Iran, and they're Shia, and they have been shooting at and killing American Israeli civilians and Israeli IDF forces for a long period of time. if this gets hot on the northern border, and it's already hot, if it goes to full-scale conflict on the northern border of Israel, do you expect the Israelis to hit Iran?
Not initially. I think that if the Iranians unleash Hezbollah, as you well know, they have over 100,000 surface-to-surface missiles that pose a truly existential threat to Israel. If Hezbollah moved toward a massive set of attacks, Israel would begin by responding and taking out much of that targeting and missile structure in Lebanon. However, if the Hezbollah landed strikes, major ones against big Israeli cities, think Tel Aviv, Haifa, perhaps Jerusalem itself, in that case, I think Israel would strongly consider going after Iran itself. Let's hope we don't get there, because down that path is a much wider war and almost certain U.S. involvement.
So, you know, Admiral, I heard yesterday on one of the podcasts, I think it was Dan Senor talking to Haviv Rediger, that Israel almost has no choice because the Hezbollah keeps firing the directed missile into the window where they killed a mom and her son having breakfast, that they've got to move them back behind the Litani because rockets are the precision guided handheld munition that goes in a direct line is very different from the rockets that Hamas is using where they don't know where they're going. They've just got to move them back. And so he thinks it's inevitable. Your assessment of that inevitability?
I think Israeli military planners are looking day by day, hour by hour, minute by minute about their options. And certainly one option would be for Israel to mow the lawn north and just clear out anything that has that point-to-point short distance that you're talking about. The ballistic missiles, the longer-range ones, to get at those, you'd have to go deep, deep into Lebanon. I don't think Israel wants to go there yet because they know it means a wider war.
And is there already a target set for Iran? Do you think the IDF already knows the order? We got less than a minute. The number and order in which of targets that they would strike in Iran if they did that?
100%. All militaries, in the end, are big file cabinets full of plans. The Pentagon is one huge file cabinet full of plans to strike our adversaries.
All right. Admiral Stav, always good to talk to you. 2054 in bookstores now, available at Amazon.com, available at BarnesandNoble.com, available at Admiral Stav's own website, 2054. You want to know what the future of warfare looks like? Read 2034, then read 2054, and the next one, and you'll know. You don't have to wait for it. Preview of coming attractions, and they're not fun. Stand by, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Want to remind everyone, a great sponsor of the program is MyPhDWeightLoss.com. Generalissimo went on that program more than a year ago, lost 50 pounds. He's kept it off. And stress eating is not allowed, I don't believe, even though we're under a lot of...
Sure tempted to this week, aren't we?
Everybody is. But we don't... I'm sure they give you tricks of the trade to combat that, because that's one of the habits. You broke that habit. You're not going by Del Taco or Taco Bell.
Have not. No.
You haven't relapsed.
Have not relapsed.
And that is and it's healthy, it's wise, it's productive.
864-644-1900.
That's
864-644-1900.
Joined now by Brett Baer of Fox News. Good morning, Brett. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. Doing well.
15 years you've been anchoring Special Report, and in that time, lots of things have happened with significance. Now, I wasn't startled by the attack on the Iranian embassy last night that killed two Quds Force General and seven other commanders. And I don't think it was unexpected. And I'm not really sure it's an escalation like Reuters calls it. But how significant is that in your experience, Brett?
Well, I think it's significant that Israel is feeling like they are emboldened to go not to just Hamas leadership, but also to Iranian leadership, because that's frankly where everybody knows the support and backing is coming from for Hamas and Hezbollah. And, you know, it's interesting that in this environment, Israel is, you know, still on the offense to try to deal with the threat that they face.
What do you think goes on? You covered the Pentagon for a long time. After an attack on what was previously an out-of-bounds target occurs, what do you think they're talking about in Tehran this morning?
You know, how to retaliate, how to push back. And, you know, I do think that they're fairly limited. I mean, they do have scope in their abilities through their terrorist partners. But as far as directly responding, it is delicate because right now the U.S. is in the mindset that they don't want an escalation in the region. It's already escalated. And the question is what the Biden administration chooses to do. You know, obviously, there's critics who say Trump Iran and
You must be. Your cell is cracking up on us there, Brett. You must be going around one of Georgetown or up on the hill where their jammers are. Let me try this again.
Can you hear me again?
Yeah, I got you back. Let me rephrase this. If Iran does something new, we'll know about it. And is that then, at that point, I expect Israel to escalate and hit Iranian targets. If they put their name on something, do you think that Iran would dare do that? Because that puts all of their oil refineries on the map, because that's what Israel would hit, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't think that that's going to happen. I think, and that was my point in the thing that you couldn't hear me, is that they have a lot of reach with their terrorist partners. But as far as putting their name on some response, I think that that's a, you know, interesting move if it happens. I think that the Biden administration's moves are the most interesting to watch based on, you know, what they do directly with Iran.
Well, they took the second carrier out. I kind of hope they get a second one back there. Now I want to flip entirely over to something Fox has been covering quite a lot of, and I'm glad. John Barrasso was on Fox Business yesterday with David Asman talking about the EV mandate, cut number 14.
And the detached under the sun, this is economic suicide in the name of climate science. And to show you how detached they are to your point, David, so the EPA made this announcement about how much carbon will be avoided going into the atmosphere, and it's going to take 30 years to avoid a certain amount of carbon. Well, it's the same exact amount that China and India put into the atmosphere, added to their carbon footprint in last year alone. So they're going to penalize the trucking industry, penalize the drivers, penalize the consumers to accomplish in 30 years what China and India are adding in climate to the atmosphere in 1 year alone.
Brett, do you think Joe Biden knew what the EPA was doing yesterday? Because to me, his whole, I didn't know about the Transgender Visibility Day. That wasn't me. It bespeaks to the whole idea that he doesn't really know what his most loyal ideologues are doing in the agency. Because that's just nuts before an election to do what they did yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, it was first kind of snuck in on Friday, the actual regulation, on Good Friday before Easter weekend. And, you know, there's a reason, obviously. It has big implications. And I think you're going to see pushback not only in the trucking industry, but also by consumers who eventually are going to eat the cost. You know, we're just coming off of what is a significant inflation increase. And if you feel any more, that's going to turn things. You know, I think Barrasso is right in a sense that that is not a winner for Democrats. They've got a number of winners. They've got abortion. They've got threat to democracy. Those both seem to resonate in the polls. But this turn does not.
Well, I would just love to know. I don't have a staff. Maybe you will be able to find this out someday. How many truckers live in the swing states? And, you know, we're talking Wisconsin and Nevada and Pennsylvania. Because I used to, long ago in the Paleolithic age, I was a lifeguard during the summers of college, and I got to know some truckers who had the apartment complex where I was working. And these guys owned their trucks. And the idea that they can't drive their trucks, everyone in the fleet right now has to go buy an EV in some period of time. That's just electoral suicide, Brett.
Well, not only that, Hugh, you can't make it across the country currently.
Yeah, well, there's that too.
I mean, if you're not, if you're gonna mandate,
well, if you're gonna get all factual on me, Brett,
you gotta have the infrastructure. You gotta have the infrastructure. It's not there. You know, there were billions and billions of dollars in the infrastructure bill for that very thing. There hasn't been one EV station created in that.
There has not one. Oh my God. But they're going to rebuild the Francis Scott Key Bridge, not to worry about that. All right, now I want to go to the polling. I asked a few people today. There are head-to-head polls. Most of them have Trump ahead. A couple of them have Biden ahead. And that's interesting to me. But it seems to me inevitable that we're going to have a five-person race, Brett. I know he's not on the ballot everywhere, but what are your odds at Robert Kennedy Jr. being on most, if not all, of the swing state ballots?
I think they're pretty high. They're above 50. I mean, they're probably 70. I think he probably gets on those ballots now that he has a running mate.
And now, Cornel West and Jill Stein, you think they're going to be on there too?
Yeah, I mean, there's an infrastructure for Green Party. Cornel West is a little bit different, but I think he could. Now, if somehow Robert Kennedy got with the Libertarians, he would be on almost every ballot.
Yeah, he'd be the least libertarian ever, but that would still be on the ballot, and they wouldn't know that. Last question for you, Brett. When that becomes obvious, will Fox abandon the head-to-head and go only to the five-way, which is what I hope pollsters start to do now, because I think it is inevitable that Robert Kennedy Jr., or at least put Kennedy and Jill Stein on there, maybe not Cornel West.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think if it's at least all of the swing states, or most of them, that will change what we put up. I mean, we poll on that anyway. So every time we do have a head-to-head and a five-way. But, you know, the change in our latest poll was, you know, basically the same difference. Trump was up 5 in both.
That's kind of stunning, isn't it? 5 points. And I think a conviction will help him in New York because it's such a bozo case. And I think he's going to get convicted in New York. But 5 points is pretty big at this point.
It is. It's a plus or minus 3. I think, you know, after you get to September, that's where the likely voters and that polling starts to narrow, I think, not as far as numbers, but as far as its accuracy. At least we've seen that.
All right, bonus question. I was on with Jillian sitting in for you on Friday night, and she asked me about the big $25 million fundraiser the night before, and I told her my best take is money isn't going to matter that much in this race. I don't really care if it's a $50 million or a $100 million advantage to the president. It's not going to manage because you can't de-age. There is no machine for him to buy to go in and go backwards. What do you think about money, Brett? We have 1 minute.
Yeah, I just think that money, it's not the factor, but it is a factor. And it is a factor less about commercials and about message and more about get out the vote and mobilization of voters on the ground.
And on that, they got to have people to drive people to the polls. Brett Baer will be watching tonight on Special Report.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.